Good morning. First case today is United States v. Jesse. Appellant prepared to argue? Okay. The government? Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Zachary Gray, and together with Captain Ben Accinelli, we represent the appellant, Chief Warrant Officer to Lamont Jesse. Chief Judge, if I may reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The Army Court erred for one primary reason, namely, when it failed to reach appellant's constitutional claims that his sentence had been unlawfully increased, and thereby the Army Court failed to exercise its statutory mandatory duty to determine that the sentence was both correct in law as well as that it was appropriate.
Counsel, before we plunge into that, your client got what he wanted.
Your Honor,
your client wanted this reg modified. He got it. Plus, he's not in confinement anymore. What are we doing here? Are we talking about an abstract proposition of constitutionality? Or what are we doing here?
No, Your Honor. Appellant, from the beginning, has always asked that this court, well, and specifically the Army Court, determine that his sentence was appropriate in law in light of the fact that it was being unlawfully exacerbated.
Okay, well, we don't do that.
Your Honor, this court, since it decided Sanchez in 2000, as well as Irby and White, and then Pena, this court has repeatedly said that it will look to whether or not a sentence is being unlawfully increased in violation of both the Constitution, Article 55, and Pena actually expanded that construct to sit for an entirely distinct line of analysis to say even if it wasn't a constitutional or a statutory violation, does this prison policy, in Pena, for example, it was the maximum supervised release program, and it looked to whether or not that policy unlawfully increased the nature of his sentence.
But the nature or the sentence?
The sentence itself.
The sentence itself, right. That's what we're talking about.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
Can I just ask a point of clarification there?
Yes, Your Honor.
Based on your reply brief, it's a little bit unclear to me whether you're no longer pursuing your Article 66C sentence appropriateness argument. In your reply brief, you talk about the sole claim is that he was confined in a manner that violated his fundamental constitutional rights. Are you no longer pursuing?
No, Your Honor, and thank you for giving us an opportunity to clarify. The point was namely made in response to the government, and the point we wanted to make was that the court shouldn't collapse the sentence appropriateness and the legal correctness, that Irby and White make it clear that those are, in fact, two different lines, but we believe that the Army Court erred both because it failed to determine that the sentence was correct in law, but then secondarily, because it abused its sentence appropriate discretion. As this court has stated in Bayer, Tardif, and multitude of other cases, the Army Court has a duty in every single case to individually determine whether a sentence is appropriate. And when they fail to reach the underlying merits, particularly of constitutional claims, the Army Court cannot, one, determine that the sentence was correct in law, and it certainly can't determine whether the sentence is appropriate in light of those constitutional violations,
Your Honor. Did the CCA address both of those prongs in your view?
No. Our position is that the CCA, in reading Irby and White, wholly read over the fact that those cases made clear that there's an independent duty to affirm a sentence as correct in law.
How did that come about in your view? I mean, it seemed as if you raised before the CCA and the government raised before the CCA that prong, but then the CCA only seemed to address the single prong. Was there something that evolved in the course of that?
Your Honor, our position is that Article 66, Charlie, by its plain language, that the court may only affirm a sentence as correct in law, fact, and should be approved, combined with Irby and White, created a somewhat difficult set of cases for the Army Court to work around to suggest that they could somehow have the discretion to decline to reach a substantive legal issue. And so I think that the Army Court accidentally misread both of those cases as overly confined, and I think they did so because of their erroneous reading of Healy. They took Healy to mean that both Healy and Gay to suggest that they have the discretion to reach these issues, and neither of those cases did. Healy, as the dissent in this case pointed out, Judge Schlossberger, was limited to clemency. It was a purely clemency case, and it makes sense when understood in that context, because this court has said, in NERAD and for us, since Healy, that the court doesn't have clemency authority. So these 25 documents from Healy, they all went to clemency. We don't even have jurisdiction over that, so we're not going to reach that. And so ultimately, we think that the Army Court erroneously cabined Irby and White in part because of their reading of Healy.
Is it your contention that they didn't get into it at all, or they just answered it wrong?
It's our contention that the Army Court did not and could not resolve either legal correctness or sentence appropriateness.
Why? Because of what we said?
No, because they candidly said that we believe we have the authority to look at these issues, but ultimately we decide that we should not.
Well, that's what I'm asking. What I'm saying is they didn't, they couldn't, or they didn't. They didn't. And they didn't because they thought they had discretion.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Precisely.
And what you're saying is you guys, meaning us, say you don't have discretion. And therefore go back and do it again.
That's correct. Today, the only remedy that we are requesting is that this court return this case to the CCA.
Well, it's the only remedy you got because, as I said, the regs changed and he's gone.
So Chief Jesse technically is still in confinement right now, even though he hasn't hit his maximum eligible release date. He has hit his minimum. He has hit parole. And I'm actually, he's also recently been allowed full contact with his children after the policy has changed.
Yeah, so that's mooted.
So it's mooted insofar as...
It's mooted as far as anything can be mooted.
But
it's over.
It's mooted.
He's seeing his kids and the administrative process worked.
So, Your Honor, the appellant doesn't agree with much that the majority in the Army Court opinion said, but we do agree with one particular note that they made, and that would be... at Joint Appendix page 7, where they specifically say that if this would warrant sentence relief, the fact that the policy has been modified would not alter the appropriateness of appellant's sentence. Our suggestion is that the harm has been done at this point. So irrespective of any sort of enjoinder, which is no longer needed because the policy has been changed, and whether or not he is in confinement, that doesn't change the fundamental fact that his sentence was unlawfully increased by a policy that was plainly unconstitutional.
Counsel, may I ask you a question about the about your theory of how far your claim goes? It seems to me that Irby is the case that's most directly analogous to the current case in the sense that it was an Eighth Amendment claim and it was not presented to the convening authority, but we said that the CCA should have considered it. The government seems to suggest, well, that's Eighth Amendment claims, and you say, well, no, it goes further than just Eighth Amendment. It could extend to this constitutional claim. Are you saying that it would apply under your theory that the CCA would have to consider all constitutional claims, all constitutional and statutory claims, or anything that might affect the sentence? For example, conditions of confinement that are not illegal or unconstitutional, but are maybe just harsher than what would be anticipated by the convening authority and the panel?
Yes, Your Honor. So our position is that whether it be, I think that the most doctrinally clean way to address this is not to divert or not to distinguish between constitutional and statutory or even regulatory rights, but rather to look to rather to look to determine whether or not something constitutes atypical punishment. Because the bucket that we think it most accurately actually encompasses, Irby is close, but we also think Pena is very instructive. And again, that's because Pena set forth the language where it looked at whether there was a constitutional violation or an express prohibition under the Uniform Code, and then it, under a separate analysis, it looked to see whether or not the policy otherwise unlawfully increased the sentence. And so I think that this court can cabin the principles from this case by at least requiring that the legal defect constitutes some sort of punishment. The Mendoza factors lay out the test, and I think under this case, this would constitute atypical punishment.
Atypical or impermissible?
Your Honor, atypical as a...
You're threading this needle nicely, but I'm just with Judge Maggs. I'm wondering where this goes.
Why doesn't it open the floodgates?
Exactly. Why doesn't this open the floodgates to every gripe about... Fine, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, how do we cabin what you're suggesting to not end up supervising the rules and regulations at the institutions? Right, which is, how much food is enough food? What type of food is enough food? How clean is too clean? How clean is not clean enough?
Yeah, so I think this court has actually done a good job thus far of...
Because we've stayed out of it.
Well, in a case like White, for example, and I think the way that 99% of these cases are going to get dealt with is that there's going to be a conversation between the appellant and between appellant's counsel, and they're going to say, my bed's too hard and the cheese sandwiches don't taste good, and we're going to say, that's not a colorable claim. We're not going to raise that.
You have a lot more confidence in yourself than I do.
Well, then as a secondary backstop, Your Honor, try not to take that personally. As the secondary backstop, I think White is a good example. In that case, the court looked to his complaints and easily said, okay, even assuming that everything that you say is true, under Ginn factor number one, this doesn't rise to a constitutional violation. It doesn't unlawfully increase the punishment, and off you go. Our position is not that the courts...
Well, no, that's not what bothers me. The Constitution doesn't bother me. An actual increase in the punishment doesn't bother me. It's the notion that some ill-defined thing out there constitutes an increase in punishment when it doesn't on its face.
And that's why the CCAs, Your Honor, would be able to dispose of these readily.
Well, and that's their job under sentence appropriateness, and it's not ours.
And Your Honor, I couldn't have made the point better. It is their job, and they failed to do it here. And that's why we're...
And I would submit that our review over that kind of thing is, to put it charitably, limited. But go ahead.
Captain Gray, your basic complaint is that the CCA didn't consider the issue. They decided not to even consider it, right? And you're not saying necessarily what the outcome would have been. I mean, you're advocating for a particular outcome, are you not?
Well, we believe that the outcome would have been that it would have been unconstitutional, unlawful increase, so on and so forth. But yes, Judge Barks, you're correct that we are saying fundamentally they didn't make a decision.
Yeah, and I mean, it would go back, if we sent it back to them, tell them to now consider it, they might very well consider it and conclude not in your favor, shall we say.
They could, Your Honor. I think we'd take the position that would be an abuse of discretion on their part, but that's hopefully a question for another day.
Well, if it goes back and comes back, then you can come back here and make that argument, can't you?
I'd sure try.
All right.
Counsel, can I ask you another question, which is, suppose this policy is no longer in effect, but suppose it were, and we were to say this policy violates the First Amendment. What authority would we have, what responsibility would the prison have to follow our decisions on this particular point? For example, we've had a case just 2 weeks ago, you may recall, in which the argument was that DFAS doesn't have to listen to our decisions. Do the prisons have to listen to our decisions on whether their policies are constitutional or not?
Your Honor, under this case, because the court has spelled out the fact, the high court has spelled out the fact that this court doesn't have the authority to regulate the administration of the prison facilities, they could very well disregard the instruction of this court, but that exemplifies precisely the critical distinction here, which is that we are not asking the court to enjoin the policy. We're not asking for a writ of mandamus to change it. Instead, we are simply asking that the CCAs take into account the manner in which this increased his sentence unlawfully and to appropriately credit the appellant at that point.
Why isn't the CCA correct that the question is better asked of a court that could enjoin the prison?
So, Your Honor,
I think that was part of the import of their argument, right? It wasn't just, we don't feel like working through this problem. It was, we don't think that we're the right place to go.
It was, Your Honor, and we find two problems with that, at least. The first being that whether or not the appellant has an alternate forum where he can achieve an alternate remedy, I don't think that has any bearing on the Army Court's statutory duty to determine the sentence is correct in law as well as that the sentence is appropriate.
But it did determine that it was correct in law and that it was appropriate. It just declined to factor in this point that you wanted it to factor in. Right? I mean, it did say, it did find that the sentence was correct in law, in fact, and that it should be approved.
The court does say that it affirms the findings and sentence, Your Honor, and I'm not trying to parse hairs. So
you're basically saying they advocate they didn't do what the statute requires them to do. They did do it. They just didn't consider this factor, which you think that they must consider.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they declined to consider it for the reason that they stated.
Yes. And so the first being that we believe that they have that duty. But it's also unpersuasive in light of the fact that you can't rely on saying the Article III courts are better positioned to enjoin a policy that had changed at the time.
Captain Gray, let me ask you this before your time runs out. What about the point made that it took about a year for the convening authority to act in this case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Almost a year, maybe 11 months. And during that time, the accused was in the joint confinement facility. This policy was being imposed on him, yet he chose not to or could not or did not, for whatever reasons, present his claim in his 1105 or 1106 matters. Does he have to, and does it matter when he brings such a complaint? I'm just curious about that.
Sure. Chief Judge, I see that my time is run.
Would you answer the question?
So I think we all have a general sense of the Byzantine nature of prison administration policies.
Never been to prison.
I'm glad to hear that, Your Honor. I don't think that one can gain any sort of meaningful sense of how aggressively somebody pursued something. I mean, you can see from the process itself, it's a fairly convoluted process as an attorney. You know, I had to read the various policies and their explanations multiple times, and it's not something that is widely available. They don't just give these policies out.
No, I understand that, but isn't he still represented when he's in the 1105, 1106 phase?
We think that old cases like Fagnin and Healy, for example, have drawn a line to say that the record itself consists of everything up to the point that the convening authority considers the record. And we think that is a distinction, but this court has identified so many post-trial issues under the Fifth Amendment with post-trial delay, with unlawful command influence, the Sixth Amendment with ineffective assistance of counsel, and of course this line of Eighth Amendment cases, that we don't think that the RCM 1105 or the record, making it into the initial record, should be a dispositive point, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Suki, judges of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Christopher Layton, and along with Major Hannah Kaufman, I represent the United States. This court should affirm the judgment of the Army Court because the sentence in this case is correct and appropriate. First, this case can and should be decided on non-constitutional grounds, because even if the policy in question unduly infringed upon the appellant's freedom of association, which we submitted did not, that infringement does not relate to the correctness or appropriateness of the sentence in this case. Second, the Army Court did not abuse its discretion when it decided this case without appellant's untimely submissions. And third, the Army Court was not required to resolve appellant's complaints as a part of its Article 66 review, and it lacked the authority to grant relief tailored to those claims in either event. Regarding the record in this case, appellant's claims were not in the record at the time of direct appeal, though they easily could have been. Second, appellant did not assert a claim, the nature of which would even require the Army Court to open its record. And most importantly, the Army Court decision was not an abuse of discretion, the standard at play here, because it very thoughtfully parsed out in 15 pages between the majority and the concurring opinion, exploring the nature of the outer bounds of Article 66C and this Court's recent precedent in U.S. v. Gay, U.S. v. White, and U.S. v. Irby.
Your argument, your position that he could have easily included this in the record is based on what?
Well, Your Honor, the appellant...
I'm assuming you also have never been in prison.
I have not, Your Honor.
All right.
Thankfully. But the appellant 1105s, as you pointed out just a moment ago.
Right, but counsel informed me that, possibly correctly, I don't know, that there's this Byzantine nature of being in confinement that might preclude someone who may not be properly or improperly represented to bring forth a claim.
To that I can only say, authority. Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. To that I can only say in U.S. v. Gay, in which that appellant was actually in solitary confinement, he was able to get these matters in his 1105s. And this appellant was operating under this policy since day one, and so for 370 days operating under this policy, his 1105s are silent on this issue. Moving to the second assignment of error, which is in my reading about the outer bounds of Article 66, the Army Court did conduct a valid Article 66 review because it acted within the scope of its statutory mandate and this Court's precedent, and it very carefully unpacked both of those items throughout its opinion. This is not a case where the Army Court punted. It thought about it on every level, and it indicated that as a court of limited jurisdiction and not a court capable of granting injunctive relief to which the government submits appellant could have availed himself for up to a year, the Army Court considered that, and it decided that it should not resolve issues beyond its statutory and logical purview. And I say should, Your Honor, because using this Court's language in United States v. Gay, there are situations where the CCAs must consider post-trial confinement conditions. They absolutely must, and they must open the record to material supporting those complaints.
Well, he's not, as I understand it, he's not saying that the CCAs should have resolved it, although I'm sure he wishes they had. I think his claim is that they should have at least considered it.
Judge Sparks, I think he's saying...
One and the same thing, or what?
I think what he's saying is the Army Court punted on that. It didn't even engage it, and it absolutely had a duty and a mandate to do so. And in support of that proposition, throughout the briefing, we keep seeing the cite to United States versus White. But if the Court were to read two sentences above that citation, they would see clearly that when this Court said constitutional and statutory issues, it's talking specifically about the Eighth Amendment of the United States Constitution. All of these cases are Eighth Amendment cases. All of these cases, in conjunction with Article 55, stand for the proposition that...
What does it mean that a sentence is correct in law?
To be devoid...
Is it like the terminal element in Fosler that you tack on, or is it that's got some substance, or is it something else? Or is it... I'm asking. I don't know. We've got some loose language here in Irby where we seem to analogize what the CCAs do to what we do, and that I find that puzzling. But go ahead.
Your Honor, I think my best answer is a legal error, a legal deficiency, is one which relates directly to the findings and sentence in the case. And all we can look to is the plain language of Article 66 and this Court's precedent in ascertaining putting more meat on the bones.
Well, in other words, what you're saying is the language is surplusage?
I don't know that it's surplusage, Chief Judge Suki, but it's very clear and it's very well captured in the Army Court's opinion that the situations where they absolutely must review these post-trial confinement complaints are ones that impact the Eighth Amendment or Article 55. And that's been, I won't say expanded, but that's been interpreted to mean things that are happening in prison that unduly increase the punishment.
Well, we're all talking about things happening that unduly increase the punishment, whatever that is. You know, to me, increasing your punishment means you're raising it or you're going beyond what the table says in the MCM. Or there's an intent to punish. None of which seems to appear here.
I agree.
Maybe it's our fault for loose language, but I still don't know what it means apart from the Eighth Amendment, 55, or obvious instances of actions motivated by a desire to punishment, to punish, that comes under this rubric of being correct in law.
That's exactly right, Chief Judge Suki. And all the cases cited in this dialogue, back and forth, almost all of which directly at least cite and move under the Eighth Amendment, which
Counsel,
deals with abuse and punishment.
On that specific point, though, in the reply brief, appellant says that the government hasn't explained why it should be limited to the Eighth Amendment in Article 55. That, I mean, certainly Irby is an Article 55 Eighth Amendment claim, but what is the government's position of why it should be limited? Why is the Eighth Amendment an exception to the ordinary rule?
Judge Max, I think that's because these are courts of limited jurisdiction, and they operate under the precedent established by this court, and that is the only framework that we've ever operated under. Eighth Amendment cases, Article 55 cases, which are rationally related to these complaints.
What about Sixth Amendment ineffective assistance of counsel claims? You can bring in an ineffective assistance of counsel claim that was not reviewed by the CCA. That's a Sixth Amendment claim, and that seems to be an exception.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's another specific carve-out codified by the precedent of this court, and that's why the government's position is the Army courts just need to follow this court's direction in its precedent, and that's what they did here.
To say simply that we've set it for the Sixth Amendment and the Eighth Amendment, but no further. I mean, that's whether those were justified under a bigger theory or not, that's the only precedent, and we stop at those two rights.
As of this moment and this point in the development of the law, yes. Moving forward, the appellant's...
And before you move on, could I address what you mentioned earlier in your opening, that basically I think what you said is that even if they had considered this, the CCA, that there's no constitutional infringement here. So this is not a constitutional case. Is that what you said, or did I mischaracterize what you said?
Justice Sparks, our position was this policy does not unduly infringe on this appellant's freedom of association. Right.
Well, let me ask you this. Would you agree that there is fairly ample support for the proposition that even confined individuals have some right to intimacy? I mean, intimate relationships, like with their families, with their wives, maybe even with their girlfriends, I don't know. But let's leave it at the wives and children for the moment.
Yes, Judge Sparks, there is Supreme Court case law on point to just that effect, that you don't surrender absolutely every aspect of your freedom of association.
So your position would be simply, in this case, had the court considered it, that this policy simply does not infringe that admittedly limited right.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Counsel, before you move on, also, can I ask a question? In the en banc decision, it said we're now going to deny the motion to attach.
Yes, sir.
However, then the CCA seems to discuss in some depth the prison policy that was part of what was supposed to be attached. How did that work?
Admittedly, Judge Olson, I've certainly found no other specific precedent where the record was handled in this exact same way. And the way in which the Army Court in Bonk handles the handling of the record is not for me to comment on. But I would say the government's reading of that is everything came in initially, and then in sifting through it, it became evident to the court en banc that this material is absolutely irrelevant because they don't have to get to the underlying issue. And that's why we get the footnote where it's not deleted. It's in the file. It's for the dissenters to consider and for this court to consider, but only insofar as it's necessary for this court to determine whether the Army Court majority abused its discretion in deciding it didn't even need to consider it in the first place. Moving on to the issue of sentence appropriateness, appellant suggests that relief is appropriate and it should be in the form of sentence appropriateness. Again, the Army Court spent considerable time explaining why that was an inappropriate use of that power, why that is not a limitless power, why Jesse is a poor candidate for the use of that power. And that's because sentence appropriateness is a blunt tool. It's a blunt tool, and it's a blunt tool in a situation where a scalpel is not only more appropriate to get at the actual issue, but it's available. And the government submits that the appellant could have gone and pursued injunctions.
Counsel, you kind of lost me there. It seems to me sentence appropriateness is the tool for the CCAs to resolve this kind of stuff. Without, God forbid, dragging us into it. Because sentence appropriateness is theirs and it's not ours. And so why isn't sentence appropriateness an appropriate tool to grant relief if the CCA thinks relief is warranted?
Chief Jasuki, first and foremost, because sentence appropriate relief, credit, money, it does not address the offending condition in this case. And this court, actually, Your Honor, recently
said, well, it's kind of like the chancellor's foot. You know, it's all you got.
And they are well aware of that, Chief Justice Suki, and they said this is not a good candidate, this is not an appropriate use of that power. And citing language that you used during U.S. v. Gay, this court affords very broad latitude to the CCA in that decision-making. That is their wheelhouse. And if I could just read a small piece of U.S. v. Gay, this court stated that in reaching this conclusion, we do not recognize unlimited authority of the CCA to grant sentence appropriateness relief for any conditions of post-trial confinement of which they disapprove. Rather, we hold that the Air Force CCA's decision to grant the sentence appropriateness relief in this case was based on a legal deficiency in the post-trial process and thus was authorized. So in other words, CCAs cannot address all fathomable post-trial confinement conditions. And not everything that the CCA dislikes is necessarily appropriately in the bucket of sentence appropriateness. And using its discretion, that's what the Army Court found in this case.
But it seems to me that it's even more dangerous to put it into the pot of correcting law, which means nothing. Or everything, at least sentence appropriateness has some understanding, and it's statutory. But tell me, what's the government think of that?
The government agrees with the Army Court in that not all things disfavored are necessarily to be addressed with sentence appropriateness.
Good enough. Go ahead.
Any further questions of this court should affirm the judgment of the Army Court.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal? No rebuttal? Appellant waives rebuttal. The case is now submitted, and court is in recess until 10:15.